afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And my microphone is running away. There we go.
Every time he pulls it down, it goes shooting up to the sky.
So what's going on this morning?
Well, it is Memorial Day.
And it's warming up,
and
finally.
Memorial Day is not about hot dogs. And Memorial Day is not Veterans Day, because that's different. Memorial Day is remembering the fallen. So that's why typically you see our cemeteries have lots of flags and different things. We honor our veterans who have fallen while defending our country. So super important to kind of remember that we're not just a hot dog holiday or a barbecue holiday, even though that's great. And I'm sure that had we not lost those people and they were still living, they would love to have hot dogs with you too.
That's right.
But it's good that we celebrate for the right reasons. Our guest today, who was willing to hang out with us on Memorial Day, which is fun because a lot of times, you know, holiday stuff's a problem. But our guest, Claire Lopez, we have not had her on in a little bit. She received a BA in Communications and French from Notre Dame College of Ohio and a Master's in International Relations from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. She completed Marine Corps Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia, before declining a military commission to join the CIA. I decided to leave it there for a second just so people could guess.
Yeah.
In case they never heard before. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you could take a, you know, military commission or, you know, you could just join the CIA. So, fun things that Claire has done. She's been involved in all sorts of things. I will read those on different breaks. But we have spoken with her at length about lots of different stuff. And our most recent one that I have played over and over and over and over is about the two-state solution, the whole myth of the two-state solution, because that is still out there being discussed. It's got to be frustrating. I feel bad for Claire that she has to keep hearing people say things that are stupid. Stupid.
Don't we all?
She should probably wear a shirt that says, stupid should hurt. But yeah, really frustrating because the two-state solution. And if you haven't heard that, I've got to pull the links across. I just realized they were not on the page for today. Today is May 25th, 2025. And if you go there and look in the links, you'll find the link to the show about the two-state solution. Because honestly, we should all be a lot smarter about that, and people should stop saying that because it kind of makes you sound dumb.
Yeah.
All right. I spoiler alerted that. I asked Claire what she wanted to talk about today, and this was like 2 weeks ago, and she said, I couldn't possibly tell you. We have 2 weeks to go. Anything could happen. So we called it National Security Update. How's that for vague?
There you go.
Claire, how's it going in your land?
Well, hello, Aaron and Bill. Very glad to be with you guys again. Thanks for having me.
Of course.
And thank you for opening the show with, a memory of what this weekend really is about, Memorial Day, and honoring the fallen of our military who, you know, have made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of our liberty. Appreciate that.
It's really important. Okay, in fairness, I get it. It is confusing. It's a three-day weekend. It's Memorial Day. It seems veteran-y because it is, but a lot of times that gets lost in the specifics.
It does. And I mean, those two holidays, Veterans Day, of course, falling in November, but the two are similar in that, you know, both holidays honor our military. But, you know, as you said, you know, Memorial Day is to honor the fallen, those who have fallen in battle, service to our armed forces and to the American Republic, while Veterans Day is to honor all veterans of military service. And that would include, you know, those still with us and those not. My own father was in the Army in World War II. Mostly, I guess he spent his time in Europe. And I had an uncle as well who was in the Army in a tank destroyer unit that actually fought in the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh, wow.
So, those are veterans. Happily, they both survived World War II, or else I guess, you know, I wouldn't be where I am. But Memorial Day this weekend is about honoring the fallen. And that's why so many of the ceremonies will be centered on, for example, Arlington Cemetery tomorrow, when President Trump will go there for services commemorating Memorial Day, and where little flags have been placed at all of those many, many thousands of white headstones there at Arlington Cemetery.
Yep, and the Tomb of the Unknown, I just flipped over to Facebook to see the last post I had put up from yesterday, and it said, as we approach Memorial Day weekend, let us take a moment to honor and reflect on the brave men and women who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. I ask that you please take a moment to pause and appreciate the values of courage, sacrifice, and patriotism that these heroes exemplified. Whether it's sharing stories, visiting a memorial, or simply enjoying a quiet moment of reflection, let's ensure that their memory lives on in our hearts and in our actions. Wishing you a safe and meaningful Memorial Weekend. Let's honor our heroes and cherish the freedoms they fought and died for. And the background is video of Tomb of the Unknown. And my uncle, Carrie, who is still living, is my last living uncle, actually, was a Marine. And I guess you're always a Marine. And guarded the Tomb of the Unknown. I remember going there as a kid and watching him I don't know what you call it, go through the maneuvers. It was really, as a kid, it was really impressive. Still impressive.
Yeah, I've seen videos, never saw it in person, but seen videos of that walk that they do day and night, weather, no matter, storms, rain, snow, hurricanes. And they're out there. They're still
We were there in the summer in you know, on the East Coast, and we lived back there, so we knew how hot it was. But he had really hot clothes. I remember as a kid, he had really hot clothes on.
Yeah.
And thinking, oh, Uncle Carrie has to walk around in those really hot clothes with the gloves and the hat and all that. It was
right.
The whole thing was just very somber, very impressive, and kind of left a mark.
It really is. It's somber, but you know, at the same time, it's uplifting that this is how we honor, you know, our fallen military, and in particular this one at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Yeah, so we have a lot of people in the country that have kind of skipped over a lot of that, but it's coming back. You know, just right before we started the show, the little news blurb was talking about the resurgence of graduates from the different schools and the people signing up for different branches of the military, and the volunteerism has gone way up. And
that's
really pretty impressive, actually.
Well, it's in large part, of course, we know, due to the reelection of President Donald Trump. You know, whose return to the White House really has just galvanized patriotism across America. It was always there, but it felt during the last 4 years that it wasn't as valued, you know, as it should be, and as it is now once again. And that's why we're seeing such a surge in recruitment to all the branches of our service, of our military. Then, of course, President Trump, I don't know if you caught it, I was watching President Trump speaking as the commencement speaker at West Point yesterday to the 1,000 cadets there who are now graduated as brand-new officers in the U.S. Army.
That's impressive. And I did catch part of Vice President Vance's speech. That was really amazing.
Oh, right. He was at Annapolis. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was super
very
amazing.
Uplifting, wonderful speech. Yeah. I caught only parts of that one.
Yeah. But, so there's a lot going on, and, you know, it's easy to get mired in the, you know, President Biden had, you know, whatever he had for whatever years, and the auto pen was going crazy, and all these different things. And, or maybe you're on the other team and you're still harboring under the delusion that they're going to cut Social Security, which is super not happening. Still not happening.
I'm glad for that.
Good grief.
Yes, personally.
Still not happening. Never was discussed. Not happening. But, you know, regardless of which way you're looking, sometimes it's easy to miss the bigger picture. And I guess today is sort of one of those punctuation points where you go, hey, mm-hmm. take an opportunity and look at what a great country we have and the people who live here who are willing to give the ultimate sacrifice to defend it.
Exactly.
Before you talk trash about it. We said national security update. I don't know what you had on your list, but I'm sure the list is endless. So,
well, it certainly is a long one. I guess at the top of that list must be a couple of the hot spots, flashpoints today. The Middle East, obviously, Israel, Gaza, Hezbollah, and of course Iran. And then also Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen over there in Iran? Do you think they're going to bend a little bit, negotiate their position, or do you think they're going to hold fast and end
up they'll negotiate as long as we're willing to sit there and listen to their garbage.
Yeah.
They'll drag it out as long as possible. Because why? Because they are racing right now to finish their nuclear weapons program and literally go nuclear. There's a lot of talk, both at the formal talks, the last one being in Rome, I guess that was. It didn't last very long, by the way. I think it was ended after about 3 hours. But they'll drag it out as long as possible, and if they can schedule another one for some time in the future, another week or whatever goes by, they're racing. And the talks have centered and foundered, probably reached an impasse at this point on the subject of enrichment, uranium enrichment by the Iranian regime in places like Natanz and Fardo, other sites too that are not so publicly known. And of course the United States Trump administration and our envoys, in particular Steve Witkoff, you know, have drawn the line that Iran, the regime, must verifiably, completely, and permanently dismantle its entire nuclear weapons program. Yes, they have always been striving for a nuclear weapons capability. But that means, as far as the dismantlement, that means all three elements of a nuclear weapons program. Number one, the enrichment. They may not be allowed to have enrichment at any percentage ever again, as long as this regime remains in power. Under the 2015 JCPOA, that Obama deal with Iran, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it was agreed under those provisions that Iran would be allowed to enrich uranium up to the 3.67% mark. Well, if you've got the ability to enrich that far, you've also got the ability to enrich much further on. 20%, 60% is what they're now talking about. I'm sure it's much further than that, but that's what they say.
So they tell people, they tell people all the time that, well, that's just so that they can get off of fossil fuels.
No, it's not. Number one, they have plenty of fossil fuels for centuries to come.
Right.
Number two, they sell an awful lot of that, in particular oil, to other places like China. And number three, you don't need to enrich uranium yourself to the 20 or 60% level if all you're trying to do is fuel a civilian energy program. And many other countries in the world have nuclear power as part of their energy production for electricity, civilian use. But they don't enrich uranium themselves in their own country. Argentina, Brazil, there are other places that do this. They have a nuclear power for electricity production in their countries. But they don't enrich the uranium. They import it from other verified, trusted places, sources. And that's what Iran could do. So that's the first element of the three. The second element of a nuclear weapons program, of course, is the weaponization, as they call it. That is actually forming, making warheads. They've already done that, too, by the way. And the third element is the delivery system, and that would be the ballistic missiles that we know Iran has because they've shot a whole bunch of them at Israel last year in April and again in October. So all three of those elements, again, the enrichment, the weaponization, and the missiles, all that has to be completely, permanently, verifiably dismantled or no go. And that's where I think the talks are reaching an impasse. I myself thought that the talks would reach an impasse a long time ago. It's been dragged out, and they're still, I guess, looking at maybe another session. Don't know for sure about that. But at the same time, knowing from other reporting, and we can talk about where that comes from, knowing that Iran has warheads, at least a small handful, and they're working right now on finalizing those, forming them, tweaking them, whatever you have to do to get them to fit to the nose cones of their ballistic missiles. That's what they're doing right now at a number of different places we can talk about. But the urgency of that step that they're at is what is very likely, and it's reported, it's talked about at least, going to propel Israel to strike Iran in a probably prolonged. I mean, not just one day or 100 sorties or whatever, but probably over a number of days, maybe a week or more, of strikes to take out all of these different nuclear weapons sites in Iran. And of course, they would be completely 100% justified in doing so, because international law has sanctioned anticipatory self-defense since the 1600s and the time of the legal scholar Ugo Grotius.
Wow. Okay. So let's take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Claire Lopez. I just, for whatever reason, I had dropped the previous show list from all the different shows we had done with you. Do you realize the first time you came on with us was in 2016?
Oh, my. Was it really that long ago?
October 2016.
Wow.
Isn't that creepy? How old are we?
Thank you.
Well, I don't know about the weed stuff, but thank you very much anyway.
We've been pals for a really long time.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to have to come right back on that note. Happy Memorial Day. Remember, the point of Memorial Day. You heard it here on We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Liked his plans, but they came undone when it got around to God and guns. I don't know how he grew up, but it sure wasn't down at the hunting club. 'Cause if it was, he'd understand just a little bit more about the working man. God and guns. Strong. That's what this country was founded on. Well, we might as well give up and run if we let them take our God. Neck of the woods where God is great. can't know that much about them if you think we're better off without them.
You know, and that's one of the things that has always been defended. So if you still think that has no purpose in a modern society, you might look around and realize there's a big reason that we are not routinely invaded.
That's right.
Gun behind every blade of grass. All right, Claire. So, you know, go back to the enrichment thing, because that's always, they talk about it all the time. It's very offhand.
They don't need enriched uranium. I mean, does it have to be enriched to a certain point for nuclear energy?
Yes, it does.
Yes. That's the tricky
part. For energy, beyond that, that's the point. When a regime like Iran's insists upon the right to enrich beyond the level needed for civilian energy production, then we know that they're driving for a nuclear weapon, because there's no other reason to enrich to 60%, 80%, 90%. Over 90% is where you get to weapons grade.
There's no use for it.
Okay, so the thing I never understand when I hear these reports, you know, we're not going to let them, blah, 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 we're going to... How would we know? Like, you know, there's all this talk of inspections and stuff. These guys don't really strike me as super honest brokers.
No, not at all. And they've cheated on every agreement that they've ever signed, beginning with the NPT, or the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, to which they are a signatory, as well as their agreement on the JCPOA more recently. There is the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, which is the United Nations body entrusted with the management and supervision over nuclear programs of countries everywhere, including our own and everybody else's. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council, of course, United States, the UK, France, Britain, Russia, China, are all acknowledged nuclear weapons countries, as are Pakistan, India, North Korea, and Israel is thought to be, although not openly acknowledged to be. So there is supervision from the IAEA, which has a certain amount of access to sites in Iran that they allow them into, as well as monitoring cameras inside of places like Natanz. For literally decades now, IAEA reports, which I read, come out quarterly. There's something called the IAEA Governor's Board reports on the Iranian nuclear program that come out on a quarterly basis. And for a long time now, they have included in those reports the fact that they do not have access to every place that they request access and are supposed to be granted it. They note that cameras have been disabled inside of places, that they're not supposed to be disabled, and outright removed, cameras removed. The IAEA also notes that there are sites that, you know, that they're not allowed to visit, and they call, you know, parts of the Iranian nuclear program elements with, what do they call it, potential, possible, you know, military dimensions. Possible military dimensions. That's a diplomatic way of putting things.
I was going to say, that's vague.
Yeah, they're going for a nuclear bomb. So yes, there's that kind of oversight, yes, but it's not complete, it's not according to agreements, and it's been violated many times.
And they have, or I guess I should ask you, how many of their sites, their secret sites, do you think we know about? Are there some we don't know about?
Well, sure. I mean, that's why they're called secret. There are
good one.
A number.
Well, they call them secret, but I think Israel knows where they are.
Claire gets the show wisecrack right on.
There's a number of sites that are suspected or even now known, reportedly known, you know, to be unacknowledged sites. Now, according to the NPT, according to the JCPOA, et cetera, the Iranian regime is supposed to list, acknowledge all of its nuclear sites to the IAEA, and then allow the inspectors access to them to monitor them, what goes on there. And, of course, they're not doing that. But one of the big, well, a couple big discoveries have occurred. The first one I'll mention is back in August of 2002, when the Iranian opposition group, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, relying on reporting from its member organization called the MEK, Mujahideen-e-Khalq, inside of Iran, inside of Iran's nuclear weapons program. When they reported, that is back again 2002, for the first time publicly, and they blew the lid off of Iran's nuclear weapons program at that time. You know, that's more than two decades ago. And for the first time, it was publicly revealed, and there were Google Earth satellite images shown at the press conference. Press conference says that they held in Washington D.C. and Paris. You know, these great big satellite photographs of Natanz, the enrichment facility, Isfahan, the conversion facility, and a couple other places. And subsequently, more press conferences showed more of them. And that was the first time publicly that places that had been secret for however long, probably at least a good decade, that they were revealed. Following on that, we come, let's fast forward, to the 2016 heist by the Israeli Mossad of a treasure trove of documents and hard drives and thumb drives and I don't know what else out of that warehouse in Tehran, downtown Tehran, Iran. And when all of that was translated and analyzed and so forth, and Bibi Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel at the time, held a press conference about it in 2018, what was revealed was something called the Ahmad Plan, A-M-A-D, Ahmad Plan. And that was that trove of documents and all was the archives. It constituted the archives of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Hmm. More revelations of places and projects that previously had been unknown. But that was a real treasure trove to get that out of the heart, in the center of Tehran, out of that warehouse. So that really added to a lot to our knowledge of places that had not been acknowledged again. And then since that point in time, the NCRI again has held many subsequent press conferences with new revelations. I myself attended either in person or virtually three of them recently. One back in December of 24, another in January this year, 25, and the most recent one I was at April, just last month, April of this year, 2025. And to your question, Bill, about secret sites, they revealed more. And in these three, most recent of these press conferences, open to the media, press briefing, the NCRI talked about the nuclear warhead work being done at places that have been identified as ballistic missile sites. For example, a place called Semnan, another one called Shahrud, and these are in sort of upper northeastern Iran, a bit to the south and the east of Tehran, if you can think of the map there. But the importance of that is that the work they're doing on the warheads including things like exploding bridge wire nuclear detonators. Basically, that's just a fancy way of talking about the external multi-implosion site, the explosion site, the sites that have to be triggered for the bomb itself to go off. So they're talking about exploding bridge wire nuclear detonators. And then at the most recent press briefing, they were talking about the extraction of two chemicals called deuterium and tritium. Deuterium and tritium, mostly used together, are nuclear fissile boosters for a warhead. And these are extractions, they're isotopes of hydrogen is what they are. But that's what they're used for. And they're doing this, again, so the exploding bridge wire nuclear detonators and the extraction of tritium and deuterium being done not at sites previously thought to be just about warhead development, like Parchin. No, they're being done at ballistic missile sites, Semnan Shahrud, which says to me, and I think to others, that they're in the final stages of preparing those warheads to be mounted, to be affixed to the nose cones of those missiles.
Right. So those that development isn't required for regular ballistic missile development. It's only used for nuclear missiles?
Well, what we're talking about here is the mating of the warheads. And it's
right.
A procedure. It's technologically complicated and difficult. Mating of them to the nose cones of the ballistic missiles we know they have.
Right.
Now, the missiles that were shot at Israel last year, I said in April and again in October, they were nuclear capable, but not mounted with nuclear warheads at those times.
Yikes.
But the fact that now this work is going on together, the warheads and the missiles at the missile sites, speaks to me at least, and I think probably others,
yeah,
you know, that they're in the final stages of getting those warheads configured and affixed to the ballistic missiles.
And
yeah,
so how do you think Israel, I mean, how soon do you think they'll react to that information? I mean
I've
pretty
seen
imminent.
Reports, and I don't know because people are speculating. This isn't anything that's known publicly, but possibly within weeks.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. If, I mean, if they're developing that technology, to sit on their hands at this point is
These are the same people that blew them up with pagers. I'm pretty sure they're not sitting on their hands, right?
They can't. I mean, they can't.
Right.
And as I understand it, the Trump administration has basically given the green light to Israel to do what it must to defend itself,
sure,
its very existence.
Which only
and
makes
I would
sense.
I would hope that even if we don't participate in strikes against Iran in the initial campaign anyway, despite the buildup of our air forces on the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, including, well, at least formerly, B-1 and B-2 stealth bombers. I think they've returned to the United States now. But B-52s are there. KC-135 aerial refueling tankers are there. But even despite that, if we don't participate, in an initial volley of strikes, that we would have Israel's back at places like the U.N., the Security Council, for example.
Yeah, that would make sense. Well, if this was a year ago, that would all be in question. Hopefully,
really different.
Yeah, hopefully that's not a question anymore. We do have to take a quick break, and I just wanted to, for those people who just maybe plugged in or whatever, we are speaking with Clara Lopez. She served as a member of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi and also a member of the Citizens Commission on National Security. She was formerly the VP of the Intelligence Summit, was a career operations officer with the CIA, a professor at the Center for Counterintelligence and Security Studies, the executive director of the Iran Policy Committee, and has served as a consultant instructor and intelligence analyst and researcher for a variety of defense firms.
Yeah, talk about sitting on your hands.
I mean, really. So, you know, just in case you thought she was, you know, pulling this all this terrific information off of CNN or, you know, MSNBC.
You would actually be incorrect there.
Perhaps when we come back, Claire, because another little piece of your resume that's super fun to me is you have always been a supporter of acting ICE director Tom Homan. And so at some point in our conversation today, while you are our hostage until top of the next hour, we do want to touch on that. So you are listening to We the People. Again, our guest is Claire Lopez. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And I'm proud to be on this peaceful piece of property. I'm on sacred ground and I'm in the best company. I'm thankful for those, thankful for the things I've done. I can rest in peace. I'm one of the chosen ones. I made it to Arlington.
You can bet that I stand ready when the wolf growls at the door. I'm solid, I'm steady, I'm true down to the core. And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost, I know the sacrifice. Oh, and I don't want to die for you, but if dying's asking me, I'll bear that cross with honor, 'cause freedom don't come free. American soldier, an American, beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight. American soldier.
Late, great Toby Keith.
Now I made everybody else sad. Made myself sad. Yeah. I love that song. So, all right, Claire, you want to talk about Tom Homan or put him off a little bit?
No, sure. We certainly can. First of all, of course, Tom Homan, formerly the acting ICE director for President Trump during his first administration, is now the official border czar for President Trump in now this, his second administration. And, you know, just doing an absolute bang-up job, of course. And as he repeats often in the many interviews that he does for the media, they're going after the worst of the worst first, meaning they're going after for deporting. You know, if we've got the numbers are all over the map, but let's say, you know, maybe upwards of 15 million illegal aliens came through our borders, north and south, during the last 4 years of the Biden administration. And among those, I've heard the number at least, that at least 1 million of those are known to be criminal illegal aliens, meaning they have on their record they've committed, you know, heinous crimes, assault, murder, rape, child trafficking, child pornography, those kinds of things. So what Tom Homan repeats often is that they are going after these people first to deport them. The deportation is going to take a long time, but they want to start, and understandably, with these worst of the worst, and of course among them, and also those who have received final deportation orders from a court, but you know, remain in the United States still. So that's what they're doing. We hear reports almost daily, you know, in this city, that city, all across the United States, rounding up in particular, you know, gang members, cartel members. We're talking about MS-13, Prender Agua, other cartels, that are just wreaking havoc, have been wreaking havoc across the country. And what people may or may not understand is that these cartels and these gangs, I mean, we're talking Sinaloa cartel as well, Jalisco, Nueva Generacion, it's another one. They have got a presence in cities and towns across the entire United States and on up into Canada, I should add as well. As I mentioned, you know, some of that trafficking, both human and drug trafficking.
Yeah, we have a lot of them in the drug trade here in Northern California.
Across that northern border of ours with Canada, not just the southern one with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what Tom Holman is focused on first. And you can tell he means business. You know, he comes across as absolutely committed, you know, to this job of helping America to get safe and secure again. But, you know, he also, when he has a chance to, talk more about why he does what he does, you know, he'll talk about the things that he's seen in his career, both before in that earlier administration of Trump's and now this one. You know, things he's seen down along the southern, the Texas border, for example, meeting little girls as young as like 9 years old who've been serially raped on their journey up from wherever they've come from, the South, Central America, South America. He tells the story over and over again about one time, a number of years ago now, when he was down on that U.S. southern border. And as a matter of fact, this is in the movie that we made at the United West, Tom Trento's theunitedwest.org, the website, the United West, a film called Death County and the River of Broken Dreams. Death County and the River of Broken Dreams was its original name, but really should be called The Tom Holman Story because it features Tom Holman. And in that, and in other interviews, he has talked about how he was down on that southern border, when he was with ICE, and they came across a trailer, you know, one of these container trailers on the back of a semi-truck, and it had been abandoned and locked tight. The people couldn't get out, and it was out in the hot Texas sun, and when ICE did get it open, everybody inside was dead. And what really struck Tom and the story he tells, and he chokes up every time he tries to tell this story.
Got it.
I've seen him. Inside of that container in the back of the truck were the bodies of a father holding his little five-year-old son dead, both dead. And he chokes up because at the time that they discovered that, he himself at that time had a little five-year-old son. And he just, you know, he was thinking, what if that had been my boy? What if that had been my little son? And, you know, that's when you get to see the human side of this guy. Yeah, he's big, tough, enforcer of U.S. laws and our border security. But, you know, behind all that, he's a human being. He's a father. And, he's got a heart. And the atrocities that he sees, like the raped little kids, boys and girls, by the way, the deaths along our border, the dead bodies found on ranch land, on the U.S. side of the border. And that's in our movie, Death County and the River of Broken Dreams. It's in there. Walking with ranchers on their land and finding the remains of people, I mean, human beings, you know, that died out there in the desert someplace. And all that's left, you know, are the remains, bones maybe. And in the movie, we see how he, very almost reverently picks up the remains of these deceased persons, places them into body bags, and they're taken back, to ICE facilities for identification if they possibly can, or at the very least, you know, a decent burial. So these are the things that make Tom Holman human, I think. And
yeah.
I think, you know, people need to think about that, not just, Borders are going after, which I'm very glad he is, you know, big, rough, tough Borders are going after these criminal aliens.
Well, the idea that I had a conversation with somebody the other day, super frustrating. You know, the idea that they think that guys like the MS-13, wife beater, oh, we've just got to get him back from El Salvador. Oh, my gosh, this is so sad. And I'm like, which part of don't you care about our own citizens? I mean, these guys are, you know, they come here against the law. They've already broken the law just showing up.
Yes.
And suddenly there's all this, we've got to extend, you know, a million hours of court time and all sorts of latitude. I'm like, you're not following what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, where was this dedication to due process at the time these 15 or whatever million illegals, including the gang members, the cartel members, the criminals, were flooding across our borders?
Exactly.
Where was due process then?
Yeah, right?
It wasn't.
And where was it for all, where is it for all the people who've been victimized, all the people who've lost a child, all
Reagan
of those
Riley,
things? It's just
Jocelyn and Gary's, the Rachel, Madden. Where was it for them?
I have a lot of commentary on that, actually. I added the Death County and the River of Broken Dreams. I added it on the page today.
Thank you. That's good.
I was remiss, but I have added that, so it's on the May 25th, 2025, in case we replay this.
Good.
Yeah, because that's really important. And I don't think people realize, you know.
No, they don't.
At some point, if we don't, you know, if we don't expel people who came here to take advantage of us and commit crimes, they're going to just keep taking advantage of us and committing crimes, right? I mean,
it's not rocket science.
Law
enforcement doesn't enforce itself. It has to be enforced. And, you know, that's a secured, defended border is one of the definitions. An independent sovereign nation state. Without that defensible borders, you're not a sovereign independent nation state.
Yeah.
And that's what President Trump and his administration, I should name Kristi Noem as well, now the secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, doing a wonderful job, alongside of Tom Holman. And others in CBP, Customs and Border Protection, the men and the women of CBP and DeVICE, all doing the job they wanted to do. They so much wanted to do this job, you know, the last 4 years, and they were prevented from it.
Yeah.
Something, I don't know if people even realize this either, there were suicides. There were suicides among CBP agents because of the frustration and the despair at not being able to do their jobs.
Well, and the things they had to see every day.
And the things they had to see as a result of that.
Well, they couldn't do anything about it.
Right.
Could you imagine? You're a policeman in a city, and you watch criminals kill your citizens all the time, and you've got to go put them all in body bags, and you're not allowed to go after the bad guys. I mean, it's no different.
Yeah.
It's just happening in a place that doesn't impact all of us on a daily basis. I know we're running out of time at the top of the hour here. We do have a whole other hour for you. Bill said my announcement in the last hour was confusing, that you might be leaving at the top of the hour.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're our hostage for a whole
another
hour.
Yeah.
Don't be hanging up the phone. We know where you are.
No, I won't.
So we're going to come back with our guest, Claire Lopez, and you're listening to We the People here on Memorial Day. Think about the fallen who have defended our country, and God bless them, because without them, we don't have a country. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Tell you what you do.
call them a raid. Some douchebag rises up and overthrows his government. Diplomacy ain't working and ammo's all been spent. The world is in a crisis and the media's a curse. I'll tell you what to do when it goes from bad to worse. Call them a raid. Instead of 911, they're built to improvise, adapt and overcome. When you're in knee deep and you're up shit's creek, you've tried everything, tell you what you do. Call them a rain. Tell you what to do, baby. You can.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And we say it the same way every week.
Yep, we do.
And if I was listening to me, I'd be making fun of me right now, because because repetition isn't my thing. But apparently I do it. Oh, my goodness. So, our guest today is Claire Lopez. We have been chatting with Claire since 2016, and I've added those shows for you. We've talked about a lot of good stuff. A lot of, obviously, Middle East stuff, because that is her background. So I was looking at her bio, and it's like, wow. She was a member of the Congressional Task Force on National Homeland Security, which focused on electromagnetic pulse and served as a director for counterterrorism. That would have led her to work with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, the late, great Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
Yep.
And I can't tell you how many times I get an email. I just got a text message the other day from someone who said, I really miss Dr. Pry. And, yeah, he was a great patriot and super smart man. And we just really, really loved chatting with him. Big gap in the world of smartness, huh, Claire?
Yeah, absolutely. I was privileged to know Dr. Pry for a number of years, worked with him, you know, as you mentioned there, the task force on EMP. The task force continues to this day. Task force now on national security that includes and really is focused on our electric grid and threats to it, like an EMP, that's electromagnetic pulse attack, either nuclear by an adversary, enemy of the United States, or a coronal mass ejection, a solar flare coming out of the sun could do it too. But yeah, we sorely miss him. He was brilliant. He was one of a kind. But we try to carry on in his footsteps even now with the task force on national security.
Yeah, I always think of him on holidays. I remember it was Father's Day one year, and I had scheduled him out quite a, you know, like weeks prior, and I realized, oh, that's going to land right on Father's Day. And so I emailed him, and I said, hey, you know, if you want to bail, that's okay. I get it. Your family might have plans, you know. And he writes back. He goes, well, I knew it was Father's Day. He goes, Father's Day is about fathers. And that is a present that I'm going to have for myself. I'm going to come on and talk about all these things.
Peter.
It was so him. And it's funny, that was really early on. And I thought, I mean, that was kind of before we were like, you know, kind of ha-ha-ha friends on email, right? And after that, he had come on like, you know, 4th of July weekend and stuff like that. He's like, he loved having the time to discuss ideas. And
yes, he did.
Yeah, he really.
And, you know, that's where a lot of us, me especially included, learned so much.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know about EMP before I knew Peter.
No, we didn't either.
But he taught me and many others.
Yeah, and things like that, people like that, and you're included in that list. People who have a lot of information. A 2-minute, 3-minute, 5-minute interview, I mean, I'm sorry, but as a listener, I don't learn anything. I mean, I learn a little.
It goes by awfully quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah. I learn a little bit, and then I'm thinking, huh, well, that's a bummer.
Love to have heard more.
Uh-huh. So anyway, just so I don't become one of those people, let's what's our next stop along the national security update trail that we're having today?
Well, maybe we might turn to Ukraine and Russia, huh?
Oh yeah,
as developments there and in your mid-time news announcement there referred to as well.
Okay. Well, what do you think is going to go on there? I mean, if you were a betting woman.
Well, I think the.
Hey, you're not a woman.
Well, I know.
Well, who knows?
Yes, we both got a shot in.
You don't know how I'm identifying today. Lay off.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. Sorry.
I think the sentiment is that the United States is turning its back on Ukraine. I don't think that's really the case. I think our president is just doing everything he can to get both sides to the negotiating table and get them to negotiate. Because they both got their backs up, and neither one of them want to be the first to make, I think, the gesture. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, you're onto something there, Bill. Exactly. You know, let's begin where we need to begin, and that is that the independent, sovereign nation state of Ukraine was savagely attacked and invaded by a neo-empirical power called Russia, led by a president of Vladimir Putin, whose worst catastrophe, as he thinks of it in his life, was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And his mission in life, as he sees it, is to put back together again, maybe not exactly the old Tsar's Russian Empire or even the Soviet Union per se, but to reconquer and subjugate to Kremlin domination all of the Slavic areas that he can possibly reach in a bid to extend the domination of, as he would see it, Mother Russia, and as he thinks of it, all of these Slavic nations, many of them now NATO members, by the way, we should talk about that, that they should be subjugated to the domination of Moscow. That's what he thinks.
Yeah,
that's how he thinks about it.
I'm a little confused at how he could think that if he can't march into Ukraine and just take it over, how does he propose to take on other Slavic countries that are part of the UN? I mean, that's going to be a whole different ballgame.
NATO.
Member of NATO.
Yeah.
NATO, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you right now, and I've been following this very closely, there are many countries in Europe, Eastern Europe in particular, and even including NATO members, I'll say specifically the Baltics, meaning Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, up there on the edge of the Baltic Sea. Many of these countries are very much concerned that they could be next, whether or not, as they are, members of NATO. The sentiment is that Putin will not stop until he is stopped. We'll recall, of course, it was never just about the Sudetenland, was it? But once Hitler had conquered the Sudetenland, more or less with the acquiescence of the Western powers, Britain, France, others, you know, the invasion route into the rest of then Czechoslovakia was laid open, and on he went, Hitler, on he went. And that is why we see a number of the countries of NATO. The Baltic states are NATO members. So are Sweden and Finland, joined in 2023. So are many of the other countries of Eastern Europe, Hungary and Poland and Romania and Bulgaria and others. You know, even though they're members of NATO. They are worried enough. And this is part of the Trump administration's, I would say, success and priority to prod them all to increase their defense spending as a percentage of GDP. And so now we have Baltic states, Poland, and others looking towards a 5% of GDP spending on defense, which you know they had not done before, and insofar as NATO's concerned, the target goal was 2% of GDP on defense for NATO, and these states are worried enough that they're going beyond that and aiming now all the way up to 5%. The United States, for example, we spend 3 point something percent of our GDP on defense spending. But these are aiming as far as 5%. And places especially like the Baltics, also Finland. I don't know if people know this, but Russia is right now beginning to mass troops and armed forces on the border with Finland.
No kidding.
I don't know if people know that. They are.
Yeah.
And the Baltics, as I've repeated here, are especially concerned. There is a little strip of land. We should mention this. I don't know if people can mentally picture this map, the geography there, but the Baltics sit, as I said, on the shores of the Baltic Sea, and both Estonia and Latvia are directly bordering on Russia. Lithuania, the furthest south of them. Of the three Baltic states, is bordering on both Poland and Belarus, but also on Kaliningrad. Now, Kaliningrad, as people might know, is this small enclave tucked in between Poland and Lithuania on the edge of the Baltic Sea. And it is Russia. It is Russian territory. Well, if you can take a mental sort of image of the map, between Belarus and Kaliningrad, both of these Russian satraps, right, there is only a short strip. It's called, the Poles call it Suwalki Gap. You'll see it elsewhere as just Suwalki Gap. But in any case, about 175 kilometers long. It runs in a straight line. It is a border line from Belarus to Kaliningrad. If Belarusian forces, under Russia, of course, and Kaliningrad, Russia forces, could take over this gap, this line, the Suwalski Gap, they would completely cut off the Baltic states. Mm-hmm. Lithuania, Estonia, and Lithuania would be cut off from the rest of NATO to the south, Poland immediately to the south of there. So that is part of the concern. People are looking at that geography. They're looking at the buildup of Russian forces on Finland's border. Everybody knows that, you know, aggressors don't stop until they're stopped.
Right.
Well, they should know that. We have enough history.
Well, those are much smaller countries, so I understand they're a little concerned because they would get crushed by Russia.
Well, they have before.
Yeah.
Remember, of course, they were forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union after World War I. And they don't forget that. They were never acknowledged. They were never acknowledged as, part of the Soviet Union or conquered, rather called occupied, just as Eastern Ukraine right now is occupied in the Donbas. Parts of the oblasts, those are like provinces, of eastern Ukraine, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia in particular, are occupied territories, as is Crimea, occupied, but not acknowledged as Russian.
So the territory that Russia is now occupying, if they come to an agreement to let them keep that and stop the war, Does that kind of give them the green light to go attack somebody else and take their
territory? Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. And then, I mean, think, what sovereign independent nation can just say, you want Donbass, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia plus Crimea, you know, just go ahead and put their sovereign national territory and their own citizens and just give them away to the tyrannical occupation.
Yeah, because it's not just ground, it's got people that go with it.
An aggressor invader?
Right, right.
You can't, I mean, would we do such a thing?
No.
What if our West Coast were one day invaded, I don't know, by, let's say, China? And, you know, Washington State, Oregon, California get peeled off, and they're occupied by China. I mean, some would say, well, yeah, okay. But others would say, no, that's America. That's mm-hmm. America. And we don't need some other country in some other place saying, well, let's negotiate and, you know, just tell Idaho and what else, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, they'll be fine. They'll be okay. Just let them have the western states, and, you know, that'll be a ceasefire, and that'll stop the killing.
It's true.
Did we ever even dream of doing such a thing?
No. And you really do have to include that in your kind of in your thought process. You know, bring it back home and look at bargaining off. It's not just land. It's people.
It's the people.
It's people.
You know, do you consign them to subjugation under a tyrannical dictatorship empire called Russia?
Well, bottom line is, even if they were kind of nice, so let's say you're unwilling to think that they're bad guys and you think they're kind of nice, you're not a sack of flour.
No.
They're not your guys. You know,
They've already kidnapped over 20,000 Ukrainian children.
Yeah, then there's that.
And here comes summer again when they'll grab a bunch more and take them into Russia for summer camp. But they'll never return them. They'll never take them back.
Do they really call it summer camp?
There are actually summer camps, yes.
Yikes.
They really are summer camps. But they take them and they don't return them. And there are NGOs, Ukrainian and others, you know, working all the time to get these kids back home with their families and their parents. But so far they've only managed to, it's a big accomplishment to be able to return about 1,000 of them. But this is what Russia is doing. You know, I talk often in interviews and, you know, when I'm talking to people about the Treaty of Westphalia. I don't know if folks are familiar with this, but
Claire, let's take a really quick break before we do that,
right,
so I don't have to jam it up there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And our music on this break is a little shout out to our friend Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. And just in case you thought that I picked this song at random, this was his favorite song, which was just so much fun to learn. We always played it for him. These were his two favorites. Our guest today is Claire Lopez. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You got to saddle up your boys. You got to draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice.
I remember the first time I played that one, and he was really quiet, and he goes, that's eerily reminiscent. So, okay. We have the horrible summer camp where we abduct children. Summer camp is supposed to be fun. Obviously, that's not what's happening. And then they keep them. And then you moved on into the next thing, and I don't want to break that up.
Yeah, so I was going to mention the Treaty of Westphalia. In the early part of the 1600s in Europe was the horrible 30 Years' War. And the principalities and the kingdoms and princedoms of Europe just tore each other apart with huge casualties over that 30 years of the war. At the end of it, 1648, the kingdoms, the kings, the princes of what whatever was left of Europe got together in the town of Westphalia, Germany now, and decided we can't do this again. We just cannot do this to ourselves again. They lost, I don't know what it was, 30% or something of the entire population of Europe at the time. We can't do this anymore. And so for the very first time, they sat down and codified an agreement that stated that the core, the key element of the European or the world order would be the sovereign, independent nation state with defensible borders. For the very first time, that had never been the understanding before. And so you had kings and warlords and, you know, would-be emperors rampaging across the landscape, invading where they will. But now the independent sovereign nation state was to be the cornerstone of the at least the European order. Now, of course, that's been observed as often in the breach since then as not. But however, that remains still to this day the essence of our world order, that the independent sovereign nation state with defensible borders is the ideal. It's the ideal for our world order. And we're a part of that. We, the United States of America, are a big part of that. And we're vested in that, with our own interests vested in that concept. And that's why it's important that we defend not only our own borders, should be without goes without saying.
Although for 4 years we just suspended that as a concept.
But should, again, the ideal, but also why it is right that we support Ukraine in its fight to remain sovereign, independent, and with defensible borders. It doesn't mean that the United States or anybody else, you know, jumps into a border dispute anywhere in the world. No. But when you've got the largest country in Europe, that's Ukraine, not by population, but by land, geography, invaded, you know, by an aggressor neo-empirical army, Russia's, which has done this before. We've seen this play out before in Europe, and we see that happen. It is not just to Europe's benefit, to NATO's benefit, because on the other side of Ukraine to the west are so many NATO countries that we mentioned earlier. But it is in the defense of that Westphalian ideal of the sovereign independent nation state that needs defending, because it doesn't defend itself.
Well, you know, you had the League of Nations, which is now the UN. They didn't have really that great a reputation of jumping to the defense of their members. Do you think that'll be the case this time? Do you think they'll drag their feet if Russia goes in a different direction? Or do you think they will step up and stop it?
Well, here's to the credit, I say, of the Trump administration. And the prodding, the pushing by the Trump administration, you know, to the countries of Europe and particularly of NATO to up their own defense, in their own defense, as well as that of Ukraine. And as I said before, I know that many of these countries, and in particular those closest to the borders of Ukraine or and or of Russia or its satrap Belarus, that they have taken alarm, and that under that threat by Russia, by Putin, and the prodding coming from the Trump administration, they are increasing, you know, their own expenditures on their own defense, and doing other things like diversifying the sources of their energy, cutting back on energy imports from Russia, increasing imports, for example, of liquid natural gas from the United States, to sever that dependence on Russian provision of energy to them. Sanctions, willingness to go along with sanctions against Russia, its banks, its leading the members of Putin's inner circle, the Kremlin. All of these things, because of Putin's aggression against Ukraine, and because of the very committed pushing by the Trump administration for them to do more in their own defense. They're doing it. They're doing it. We talked about, meeting up to as much as the 5% of GDP investment in their own defense. But as well, we've seen, a steady and an unbroken supply of weapons and ammunition and humanitarian supplies, too, from these European countries to Ukraine. I don't think with all of the Russian propaganda, which is incredibly effective across social media and elsewhere, with all of that, I think many people may not realize the extent to which European countries have contributed to Ukraine's defense. And in terms of GDP, because that's how you have to do it, in terms of GDP per country, there are at least five or six European countries that have contributed more to Ukraine than we have.
Right. Right. And do you think Putin sees that as maybe a little stronger sign of unity, that maybe jumping into, one of these other countries might not be a good idea? Or do you think that'll even affect his decision?
I don't know. I mean, that's a debate. And the fear is, of course, that he will not see that as any kind of impediment or deterrent against further aggression. Countries like Lithuania have surged their own troops to the borders. They've closed border crossings. They're moving to call up reserves, that sort of thing. They're not counting on Putin stopping or seeing himself deterred, even with the unity that we've seen from NATO and other European countries, not seeing, that deterrence taking effect. And in fact, I'll name a plug for a good source of information on this, and that is a retired General Jack Keane's think tank, the Institute for the Study of War. They put out a daily newsletter about the progress of the Russian aggression against Ukraine. That's very detailed and very worthwhile if you've got the time to go through it. They do a nice job of providing key points. So if you don't want to read the entire, multi-page thing, you can look at the key points. But in any case, that newsletter has very often relayed in translation statements coming out of the Kremlin, coming out of, Putin and his senior leadership, like Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov or the National Security Council deputy, I guess he is, Dmitry Medvedev, and the one who's sometimes called Putin's Rasputin, Alexander Dugin. Memory is another place that translates those comments. Memory, M-E-M-R-I, Middle East Media Research Institute, Yigal Carmon's very, very useful think tank, I guess it is, but provides the two of them. They provide, other places do too, but English translations of the statements coming out of these leadership figures of Russia. And they're absolutely, at least in the statements, committed to entirely taking over Ukraine, displacing its current government, replacing that government in Kyiv with their own puppet appointees, denying Ukraine its national sovereignty, independence, denying it the ability to set its own foreign policy, whether that policy be looking to the future to join NATO sometime in the future, not now, or accepting aid of any kind, especially military, I guess, from foreign countries like the West, like Europe, like NATO. All of these are absolutely, you know, unbudgeable demands by Putin before he'll even discuss a ceasefire agreement. And we know that there were meetings scheduled last week to have been held at Putin's invitation in Turkey. And, of course, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky showed up, and so did American interlocutors, including, I think, our Ukraine envoy, retired General Keith Kellogg, and I think also Steve Witkoff, our other envoy, was there, too. They went to Istanbul, and then Putin got cold feet, and he didn't show up.
Why is that? I mean, he called the whole thing.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, in my own mind, I'm speculating, he thought maybe that Volodymyr Zelensky would not accept. Zelensky accepted immediately, kind of called his bluff.
Oops.
And then he got cold feet. Putin got cold feet and didn't show up. So what we're seeing is, and I think Trump and the administration figures are, our administration, are realizing that, you know, the real impediment to settling this horrific war, it's definitely not in Kyiv. It's not with Zelensky. It's not Ukraine. It's Russia. Russia is bent on conquest and domination, and they're not settling for anything less than that at the moment.
I've done zero research on this, but you've done tons. Has Putin ever, you know, actually entered into an agreement? Is there any history of that? Or is this going to be like the maiden voyage?
No. I'll name one. Right after the breakup of the Soviet Union, back in the early 1990s, you know, which, as we said, Putin thinks is the worst catastrophe of his life.
Right.
There was an agreement among Ukraine, Russia, U.S., U.K., might have been one or two more, called the Budapest Memorandum, because that's where it was concluded, in Budapest in Hungary. Budapest Memorandum basically said, Ukraine, if you give up your nuclear weapons, because as a Soviet Socialist Republic of the USSR, Ukraine had Russian nuclear weapons positioned on its territory. And at the breakup, those weapons were still there. And the Budapest Memorandum said, Ukraine, if you give up those weapons, return them back to Russia, we, the rest of the signatories, we pledge your independence, your sovereignty, the defense of your sovereign borders. And by the way, speaking of sovereign borders, under international law, when a former empire breaks up, like Yugoslavia did in the 1990s, say, each unit, each element of that breaks up and goes its separate way, like in Yugoslavia, you had Bosnia-Herzegovina, you had Serbia, you had Montenegro, et cetera, Croatia. Each of those goes its separate way with the borders that it had administratively when still part of the empire. Okay? So that means that when Ukraine broke away, became independent from the former Soviet Union, it went its way with its internationally recognized sovereign borders, and those included not just the Donbas, it included Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about Crimea and what it should be and what the people of Crimea wanted to be. But under international law, the country goes its way independently with the borders it had under the former empire. So the Budapest Memorandum guaranteed those borders to Ukraine. And as soon as it was possible, meaning 2014, Putin grabs Crimea in violation of the Budapest Memorandum. And at, in the same year, 2014, invades the Donbas. As we said before, there are two oblasts there, Donetsk and Luhansk. Additionally, now he's invaded two more, well, more than two more, but Kherson and Zaporizhia and some others too. So, yeah, he's broken pledges in the past. The Budapest Memorandum is Exhibit A.
He's made them and broken them.
Yeah.
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 Okay. So, what do you, if this was your needle to thread, what would, I mean, and, you know, you could, you had whomever at your disposal, who would you send and what would you do? Any
Well, I think very highly of our envoy to Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg. And I would send the message that together with our NATO allies, we will help to defend Ukraine's sovereignty and its internationally recognized sovereign borders. I very much support and agree with the minerals deal that the Trump administration has concluded with Ukraine, because under that agreement, but again, once there is a ceasefire, the United States will have a presence on the ground to help develop those mineral resources, including rare earth elements, but also other things like oil and gas, too. So I support the minerals deal or the natural resources deal. I think that's a very good idea. I know that certain countries of Europe, for example, Britain, I think also Sweden, have pledged their own forces to man a ceasefire line, to be a peacekeeping force on whatever line is drawn at the end of hostilities. So I would support all of that. But I would, in the meantime, surge to Ukraine what it needs most. And I would say at the top of that list would be air defenses. They're doing a great job on their own of you know, developing their own defense resources, like a drone industry, for example. But they need more in terms, especially of aerial defense. And I would surge those to Ukraine and also impose more and stricter sanctions against Russia and its leading autocrats. Oligarchy comes to mind.
Wait, isn't that what we have here? I've seen signs.
Some people would say that, but no, not at all. Not even close.
Not unless you're on a college campus reading protest signs.
We have to take a really quick break.
We're kind of blowing it. We're going to have all the ads at the bottom, at the top of the hour. Our guest is Claire Lopez. We're going to come right back with her again. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I pledge allegiance to this flag. And if that bothers you, well, that's too bad. But if you got pride and you're proud, you do. Hey, we could use some more like me and you. Where the stars and stripes and the eagle flies.
So you're riding with them. Make up your mind which side you stand. If you ask me, this whole world has gone to hell. I speak the truth, but these days the truth won't sell. Longer ride, I give my life. This place called USA.
A little Creed Fisher there for you.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Claire, what have we left out? Because we do have people in this country, media people, who have said, as our engineer pointed out, you know, Putin's not that bad. Like, why don't we, you know, why aren't we working with him more?
You know, as I said before, the Russian propaganda machine is incredibly effective. They have, you know, bots and presence all over social media. And people who don't necessarily, you know, swim in this stuff like we do, are taken in. They're taken in by claims that, oh, Putin is a Christian, you know, because he doesn't go for all of that LMNOP stuff. So he's a good man. And, you know, they don't understand the difference, for example, between, the Moscow Patriarchy of the Orthodox Russian Orthodox Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which have separated, as you can well imagine, and why. They don't understand that. And so they're taken in by a lot of the information operations. But, you know, as I recently spoke, to another group, it was, the North Carolina Republican Women's Federation annual conference where I spoke in, the beginning of May. And, the theme of that was that we're living in a time, as I see it, of tyranny, versus freedom. And in each one of these cases that we've talked about, and we really didn't even get to talk about, you know, Israel against, you know, the Iranian axis of resistance, as they call it, Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, and so forth. But in each of the cases, Iran, you know, the regime of the Ayatollahs against its own people. And then again, Israel being attacked by Iranian proxy, Islamic jihadi proxies. Ukraine being invaded by Russia. Here, right at home, instances hopefully now on the road to correction, but not always. But, you know, as I heard them called somewhere on a newscast somewhere, robes gone rogue. That is, black robes gone rogue. So, I mean, we're fighting the same fight here, tyranny versus freedom. And if we had to sum up all of this and more that we just, you know, didn't get to, China, you know, and, you know, the oppression against its own people, impending aggression against, you know, an independent sovereign Taiwan, all of that falls under this concept, this idea that not just our era, but in every era, really, it's a never-ending battle of freedom versus tyranny.
Yeah, somebody. I mean, you know, I think we all learned this as children, right? You know, if you have more than one kid in your family and you went out trick or treating, there was always the big kids versus the little kids, and who got the candy bars at the end. And I don't know that ever ends.
Well, it's human nature, I suppose, in some ways. But, you know, some of us here in what we call the free world try to rise to, you know, the better part of human nature. And that would be to defend concepts in our own, you know, constitution, foundational Judeo-Christian principles, although they don't have to be only Judeo-Christian, but of individual liberty, government by consent of the governed, equality of justice under the law, these kinds of principles. They have to be defended in every time and every era. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, you're, you know, a huge percentage of your career was, you know, Middle East type stuff. So when you kind of look at the big picture of the Middle East, do you think they're getting, in general, you know, stronger and bigger, more reined in? I mean, what's the trend line from your from your vantage point?
Well, I would look to the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic of Iran, as the is often called, you know, the head of the snake, or of the octopus, maybe. It's in a much weakened position right now. It's jihadi proxies, anywhere from Hamas to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, the Houthis, have all been degraded, very seriously, and air defenses, in Iran itself that used to defend its nuclear weapons sites like Natanz and Isfahan and so forth, have been taken out. The people of Iran themselves, have been fighting for their liberty for 46 years.
Wow.
And, they have the right to that liberty. And I think we have the responsibility, the obligation to help support them in that. I think now is the time that if that head of the snake, were to be taken out, that the people of Iran themselves could and would rise up, for their own liberty and to chart the path to their own future in their own country.
Well, they've had a really significant resistance movement going for quite some time.
Yes, they have.
How do you see them? It's always interesting to me that Miriam Rajavi is the head of the resistance. You know, it's just kind of fascinating that a woman would be the.
Absolutely, and that's the whole point.
Yeah, tip of the spear on that whole thing. Because there are a lot of people out here on the West Coast, at least. You have the Organization of Iranian American Communities. Oh, I always get it wrong. OIAC.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And they're great Americans who really do want their country back.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not necessarily so they can go there, but so that maybe all their friends and family and political prisoners and different people, so that they can return their country.
Well, I'll mention one thing that was just announced literally this past week, and that is an upcoming conference, dates not yet established or venue even, organized by the organization, UANI, United Against United Against a Nuclear Iran, UANI,
okay.
United Against a Nuclear Iran, together with CPAC organization of Mercedes and Schlapp, and that combination are getting together sometime this, I don't know if it's summer, but in coming weeks or months.
Okay.
To put together a conference, Matt Schlapp and Mercedes Schlapp of CPAC, together with UANI, a conference to draw together all of the Iranian opposition groups in exile. I don't know any more details than that, but it's just been announced. It's upcoming. Stay tuned.
Nice.
At either of those places, CPAC or UANI. And yes, I have worked with the National Council of Resistance of Iran, been to Paris and met Madame Rajavi multiple times for 20 years. And I would only hope that they might be part of that that conference. But again, they have been on the pointy end of the spear leading the resistance inside of Iran. And again, as we talked about earlier, infiltrating its nuclear weapons program, bringing out the information about it that we have, otherwise would not have. If and when Israel decides for its own survival that it needs to strike against those nuclear weapon sites in Iran, that very well could be the signal that the internal resistance in Iran would take as a signal for a mass uprising and take back their own country under the 10-point plan of Madame Rajavi.
Yes.
At the NCRI website, you can find those 10 points. Democratic, free market capitalist economy kind of principles. They might take that as the signal for themselves.
Well, they have said
rise
many,
up and finally take back their country.
They have said many times, privately and on air, that if the U.S. would stay out of it, stop giving Iran money, stop you know, doing all these different things, because for a while there we were actually just helping them oppress everyone. They said if we would just get out of there, they would be able to pull the pin and make it happen.
They want to do this themselves.
Yes.
They see it as their own responsibility.
They're not asking us to go do it for them.
What they want is backing. They want support. Again, you know, leadership of the United States and other Western, you know, of free nations would mean the world to them. But it doesn't necessarily mean boots on the ground at
right.
all. That's not what they want.
And they have said, please don't, actually. Please stop helping.
No.
Claire,
ahead,
we
then.
Have to run away. It's
all
happened
right.
again. We're going to come back on with you again because now, you know, we're best friends. So thank you so much for being on with us.
You're welcome.
Our guest has been Claire Lopez, and happy Memorial Day, and thank you to our service members currently
thank you,
on the ground.
Thanks, Bill and Aaron, both.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.